and I'm going to go to the second order of business, which is Senate Bill 1178, and ask Vicki Irwin to come up and put on a little show for us here, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, any members. My name is Vicki Irwin. I'm the Director of Elections for Multnomah County. I'm also today here on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Clerks. We are the ones who introduced Senate Bill 1178, and I brought with me a short video that shows the vote-by-mail process. We thought that it might be nice to have a context. And so if you don't mind, I'll go ahead and start it.
I appreciate that.
You thought we were unfamiliar with it, Vicki?
I should see that'd be fine.
A few days ago, they received their ballots in the mail. Elizabeth wrote in the ballot this morning and is ready to be returned to the election office. David is still deciding how he wants to vote this ballot. How did the ballots get to David and Elizabeth? And what happens to the ballots once they've been voted? Let's follow the journey of the ballots to find out. The journey begins in the election office so that it's a vote-by-mail supply to a mailing company, which first addresses an envelope for each voter by zip code and type of ballot. The envelope moves to a machine that automatically inputs the vote-by-mail package, a voter's template, a secrecy envelope, a ballot return envelope, and a ballot. Once the envelopes are sealed, an election worker inspects and places them in a tray for delivery to the post office. The post office whisks the ballot to high-speed call for the scanner that serves them to delivery. The ballots are then brought into the post office branch where the postal carrier prepares them for delivery. Once the ballots are delivered, the next step is up to the voter. It looks like David has decided how he wants to vote and is ready to mark his ballot. Let's rejoin him to see what happens next. He seals the ballot in the secrecy envelope. He inserts the sealed secrecy envelope inside the ballot return envelope. Seals it. Then signs the outside of the ballot return envelope. Elizabeth decides to mail her ballot to the election office. He affixes a first-class stamp and a middle for the return envelope. David decides to take his ballot to an official drop site near his work. David's and Elizabeth's ballots are collected and taken to the election office, where first the ballot return envelope is screened. Make sure they're signed. The ballot is scanned. Then we have to conclude that a ballot return envelope with a unique voter barcode number has been received and has been secret to initial verification. It goes to an election worker who verifies the signature on each return envelope. notice of signature cannot be verified, the envelope is removed to be investigated further. When the signatures have been verified, the validation envelope is sent to the scoring station for the election voters taken by precinct. The ballot return envelopes will help our precinct until the Thursday before election day. Then the ballot inspection door can open. Working with only one precinct at a time, the board places the ballot return envelope face down before removing the secrecy envelope. Before opening the secrecy envelope, the staggered ballot return envelope the check machine of the nomination process. This is done by peering through the hole in the center of the envelope. The stack is then placed in the precinct supply box. The board then removes the ballot from the tip of the envelope and checks the ballot for irregularities. If the ballot is damaged so that the vote counting machine cannot read it, the ballot is placed in an envelope and sent to the duplication board. A control number is written on the original ballot. The same number is written on the duplicate, so that anyone can verify that the duplicate is marked exactly as the original. It's important that the voter's mark on the ballot contain graphite, so that the counting machine can read the vote. So if the ballot is marked with something other than a pencil, the board requests the supervisor use a special graphite stamp to enhance the original mark. The board makes sure the enhanced mark is placed over the voter's mark. If there is writing on the ballot that identifies the voter, the election board does not allow the ballot to be counted. In this situation, the ballot is set aside in a special envelope for the effective ballot. When the board completes inspection of the precinct ballot, they are placed in a transport carrier and joins the ballot counting center. Your optical scanner tally then. When the voting deadline ends on election night, the first report of election results becomes available very soon. The ballot journey ends when the election tallies are completed. Over the years, Arizonians have cast more than 15 million vote-by-mail and absentee ballots, and the popularity of vote-by-mail increases with each election.
Senate Bill 1178 is a compilation of changes that are being proposed by the Oregon Association of County Clerks. The bill came about because of the passage of Ballot Measure 60 at the general election last year. Although no statutory changes are required in order to conduct primary and general elections by mail, it seemed prudent to review and simplify the statutes so that they reflected the new legislation. Also, several of the sections of the bill were originally in our omnibus bill, but we pulled them out and put them in this bill so that they could be drafted in the context of the overall changes that we were proposing. Generally, Senate Bill 1178 does the following thing. First, it divides Chapter 254 into three sections. Never done this to music. It divides Chapter 254 into three sections, conduct of elections generally, conduct of elections at polling places, and conduct of elections by mail. It creates a definition of absent elector. It deletes the requirement for the limited fail-safe ballot. It increases the maximum size of precincts. The maximum currently is 2,000, and this would increase it to 5,000. It changes the process for registration updates after the 21st day before the election. And it puts into statute mailed election provisions that are now defined by administrative rule by the Secretary of State. This is a long and comprehensive bill, and I prepared a section by section in order to help describe it in detail, which I will not go through unless you would like me to.
I would like to forego that. I think that we have pretty good readers, and we'll review that. But it's my feeling that this bill is through a considerable development process, and that we don't need to go through that in minute detail. Is there any questions of the witness or any desire to go through it item by item? No? All right. Appreciate that. Thank you, Vicki. I will close the hearing, open the session on Senate Bill 1178.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Barr.
Move Senate Bill 1178 to the floor to be passed.
Senator Barr has moved Senate Bill 1178 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. In discussion, clerk call the roll.
Senator Barr.
Aye.
Senator Brown.
Aye.
Senator Stone.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, Senate Bill 1178 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The chair will carry this one. With that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 1178, and we will go back to the top of the agenda, drafting and major introduction requests.
Mr. Chair, I apologize to everyone for being late. I was tied up doing some other business and couldn't get here on time. So my apologies to all the parties who had to wait for me.
Recognize that you have another committee assignment at the same time, and your excuse is well received. Your apology. Senator Beyer, drafting and major introduction request.
Got to get my script here. Mr. Chair, I would move the introduction, approval of drafting the major introduction request for the following: Senator Lynn's three requests dated 4/12/99, Senate Rules and Elections Committee request dated
4/12/99. Thank you. Senator Barr has moved to approve the drafting and bill introduction request. Senator Lim's bill stated 4/12/99 and two Senate rules and election bill stated 4/12/99. Ask the committee administrator to tell us briefly what each of those pertain to.
The first rule is an elections bill, Chair, members of the committee, comes to us by way of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee, and this is a requesting a joint resolution directing the Oregon Congressional Delegation to request the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for some relief to combat eastern filbert blight and to allow use of emergency use of necessary chemicals to combat that blight. The second Rules and Elections Bill is a technical update to the consumer finance statutes. They have not been significantly updated in at least 10 years, and we have in the hearing room today both industry and the regulator represented who are coming together to request these changes. First of Senator Lim's requests is that a commission be appointed by the government to look at alternatives to dredging the Columbia River and to look at how to develop a possible deep water port that would allow 50 ships with 50-foot draft to be accommodated. Senator Lim's second request would limit the Department of Revenue's spending on litigating a property tax dispute to the amount in controversy. Senator Lim's final request would exempt expectant mothers or on the primary caregivers for a child under the age of 6 who is not employed full-time from jury duty.
Any discussion?
No.
Thank you. Let's call the roll.
Senator Byers?
Aye.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Stone?
Aye. The drafting and bill introduction requests have been approved. We close that work session and move to a public hearing on SJM 9 and call Senator Shannon. And Irv Fletcher. I believe that.
Left meets right.
What, another labor bill?
Yeah, I'm trying to sort it.
Well, Lee Byers' name, I just got to.
That's right. There you go. All right. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Marilyn Shannon, Senator in District 15. And actually, the bill is pretty self-explanatory, and I'd like to draw your attention to line 6 through 8. It says, whereas Article 5 of the Constitution of the United States provides for the proposal of amendments to the Constitution of the United States by 2/3 concurrence of the members of both houses of Congress. And what the problem is that in the 70s, I don't know if I know the year, but
1977,
Oregon legislature sent a memorial to Congress saying, we want a constitutional convention to deal with a balanced budget amendment. And though there's no time frame. The Constitution has no time frame. That's sitting there, and as soon as 38 states send that in, we'll have a constitutional convention. And our efforts are different. Mr. Fletcher is not supporting a balanced budget amendment, and my issue is I don't support a constitutional convention because you can't control them. Once it starts, everything's on the table, and they come out with whatever they want to at the time.
Sort of like the initiative process.
Sort of. And so we tried this in 1989, but the House got spooky and it tied. It passed the Senate, but the House didn't. And so it's time, and I wish we would bring back our call for a constitutional convention. And that's why.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, Earl Fletcher, Oregon, AFL-CIO. Maybe the third time will be a charm.
Maybe.
We opposed the Senate Joint Memorial 2 in 1977. We attempted to repeal that in 1989, but they took the bill and eliminated our part and said immediately refer to the states, so we worked madly to kill that.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't pass, but hopefully our time has come. However, we're united on this issue. Maybe the only thing I get past this session is a joint memorial or a concurrent resolution. HCR 1 was one of our sponsors, you know, it passed the Senate and the House. And so we're on a roll. We're 1-1.
All right.
But our problem is that a constitutional convention would not be limited to one topic, and everything would be up for repeal or revision, and we believe that Congress already has the authority to balance the budget if they have the will to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brown.
I do have a question. How did you all come up with the idea to introduce this? Was this yours, Irv?
Well, Senator Shannon and I have a long history of working together. She was, I think, the aide to Representative Hayden, was it there?
Oh, no, dear God, no.
Who was she looking like?
He was my opponent.
I'm talking about 1889.
Senator Kinsey. I'll tell you, I went, Phyllis Schlafly.
Yes.
You don't know her personally, but I have heard of her.
She's my friend.
Yes.
And she called me up and said, you know, in some states, Maryland, the unions and the conservatives are working together to repeal this. And she told me a cute little story. She said, a broken clock is right twice a day. Don't be afraid to work with the unions. Go for it.
That's right.
As well,
that is it.
That answers your question. Yeah. I went and found Irv and said, Irv, let's get this written out.
Phyllis Shapsley and I both shared the same witness table together.
Yeah,
on this issue in 1989.
In fact, she came personally and testified in, yes, she did, in front of Grant and Karen's committee.
Right.
I bet that was a big hit.
She was very nice to her. She was very intelligent.
Good. Uh-huh. Good.
We didn't talk about the other issues.
That was a great story. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Senator Byers.
Curiosity question, because I don't know the answer. I know the Constitution provides for the call for constitutional convention. Does the language also provide for rescinding the call?
Well, that has not been decided in the courts. But if they don't have 38, then we would fight these, you know. Are they all exactly alike and everything? But it would help us just to get it out of here and just back there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does not really provide for a recall. But we'd like to do it anyway.
Pretty interesting. I introduced this bill twice in the last,
I remember,
the last 6 years, and couldn't get a hearing on it because there are forces out there in the world that believe that a balanced budget is amendment is necessary and that this is the way to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I disagree with them.
But now that we've got a balanced budget, what the heck?
That's right. Yes.
Can I just say one more quick thing? Just as an education, I know this is heard on the internet. They get on what these people that want a constitutional convention, they get on whatever horse is riding. They want to do it for term limits, a constitutional convention for term limits. They wanted to in 95 to decide the western states, how our land, because, you know, that 10th Amendment. So they were going to have this gathering 1 year and the next year. So they kind of think, they're trying to get ahead of us, you know, and get it on an issue that's so big that we'll go for a constitutional convention to get it. But now we're aware.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yes.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You. Thank okay. you. Okay.
Close the hearing. Mm-hmm. And
does anybody else want to testify?
Anyone else want to testify on this really important issue? Do I have the votes to go to a work session on this one?
If you're nice to us.
I'm going to be very nice to you. I will open the work session on SJM-9.
Mr. Chair, I'll move SJM-9 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brown moves SJM-9 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Byers.
Aye.
Senator Brown.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye. I receive the necessary majority. SJM-9 is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. That I close the work session.
Senator Shannon.
Senator Shannon will get to carry the bill.
I wonder if she could have Mr. Fletcher at her desk with her on that.
And then we're going to look here and
what is this?
We're going to open the public hearing on SJR 36. And there's a bill that I introduced at the request of Mr. Seagraves. Mr. Seagraves is here to testify, and Colleen Seelock from Election Division is here as well, signed up to testify. So, both of you come forward, please. And
Chairman Starr and members of the committee, I'm Jim Seagraves from Oregon City. I'm pleased to bring this constitutional amendment in a form that I've been advocating for almost as long as Marilyn Shannon has been working to remove that vague constitutional convention request. Representative Liz Van Leeuwen sponsored the idea of majority rule in many sessions before I moved back to Oregon in 1989. my reason for favoring majority rule is based on wanting stronger government, both administrative, executive, and legislative. I worked for 4 years in Peru in the mid-60s and mid-70s and observed the effects of multi-party systems and very divided governments. So my basic reason for wanting majority rule is based on wanting stronger elected officials with a clearer majority of the voters behind them. I noticed my notes from 4 years ago on the pros and cons of this issue. On the pro column, I have that it forces the major parties to stay near the center. It forces the candidates, too, to be near the center. So it basically favors a two-party system. I don't think there's any clear political studies that have proven that a two-party system works better than a multi-party system. It's a very hard thing to study worldwide. But I'm convinced that a two-party system works pretty well. It discourages, quote, spoiler candidates from entering a race. Candidates that know they can't win, but they might tip the results. Away from the person they don't want to win. It rewards parties for selecting stronger candidates. It helps third parties that are closer to the center than others. A third party that's close to the center might actually win. I don't have anything on my con column except that this measure, if it passed, the voters of Oregon would discourage diversity in some way. I think it would force the Libertarian Party and the Green Party on the left and the right, it would force them to be more serious. I'm very pleased that this time we were able to draft the majority rule amendment in such a way that the candidate who comes in second in a 3 or 4-way race, where the lead candidate doesn't have a majority, the candidate who comes in second would have to request a runoff election. And I'm pleased that we were able to draft it this time so that it included U.S. senators, representatives, and the governor all in one bill for the voters to consider.
Questions?
I do.
Senator Brown.
If the second person receiving the second number of votes requests the election, is that then for the taxpayers to pay for that election, pay for it?
I'm afraid that is the way it has to be now. It seems to me that we could change it so that the person who requests the runoff election would pay for half of the election or some part of it. But I've been told that there wasn't any way to really, in our democracy, require the candidate to pay for the election or part of it. I would pay for that.
I think it was in the 90 gubernatorial race. We had an interesting, we had three candidates, Al Mobley, Barbara Raverick, and Dave Frommeyer, and none of them received a majority. Under this amendment, Dave Frommeyer, I believe, could have requested another election, which means we would have to go through an entire statewide election again.
Right.
And that's really what you want us to do.
Yes, I'm saying that the candidate who wins with the majority has a stronger mandate. I'm saying that, especially with mail elections now, in my opinion, our democracy needs to be that much stronger, that we should bear that cost. We did make a rundown in 1995 of the number of gubernatorial elections that would be affected by this. And I think maybe you could address that better than I.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Colleen Sulak. I'm the Director of Elections. Building on what Mr. Seagrave said, my listing is not isolated on gubernatorial races. We prepared a list in past sessions that goes back to 1980. From 1980 through 1998, there have been 19 times when this bill could come into play. In 1998, our most recent election, we did not have anyone that did not receive a majority of the votes. I also have some other comments. I'm not sure whether the chair would like me to pursue those or if you would like to continue questions.
Please, go ahead with your comments, and then we'll open it up for questions.
All right. Thank you, Chair Starr. The only comments that I have are not either in support or in opposition to the bill, but just factual information that I hope the committee would find helpful. Of course, we would be concerned administratively about the window of time in which you run a runoff election. Because of the number of the way we process ballots, we do not receive the abstracts from county clerks until 20 days after the election, and then we certify those results within the next 10 days. So the final election results, and especially in a majority where you're really concerned about the actual number cast, we would not have the ability to call that election until about 30 days after the election. That occurs in the first week of December. Your legislative session currently is slated to begin the second week of January, so you have a 5 to 6 week window there if you would hope to have the runoff election concluded, and it would be very difficult, in fact, to go through all the steps and have that concluded. And, of course, for most Oregonians, that's a major holiday season as well. Senator Brown asked about the expense. If this was a statewide race, it would cost in excess of $1 million for that kind of a runoff. Obviously, the cost is pared down substantially. When you get to the smaller districts, the House district, I think, is around $20,000 per runoff. The only other thing I want to point out is in discussion of this bill, it's very easy to get focused on a majority being cast, and that gives the apparent winner a mandate then of the bulk of the people that participated in that election. At a general election, Oregon sees usually a 70 to 80% turnout. So there would be a substantial number of people voting in that election. We're not sure that you would see that same element of turnout in a runoff. And we do find it interesting that the bill or the resolution does not speak to whether in a runoff situation you still have the ability to write in candidates. So if indeed it was a 3 or 4 or 5 person race initially, unless you preclude the ability to write in other candidates' names, you could potentially have a runoff where the apparent winner of the runoff would not receive 50%. Georgia, in 1992, they had a similar bill. They were attempting to repeal it. I was not able to check with them. It was a rather famous U.S. Senate race where at the general election, there was in excess of 2 million votes cast. With 2.3 million votes cast at that election, the apparent winner garnered 1.1 million votes but did not receive a 50% majority. They held a runoff. Less than 50% of the number turned out. So the total number who participated in the runoff was $1.2 million, almost what the apparent winner received in the original election. Unfortunately, he came in second in the runoff, or maybe some people would say unfortunately. The second place winner got 635,000 votes. The person who received 1.1 million only received 619,000 votes. So the new winner received 635,000 votes and was elected, when in the original election, the person who came in second had 1.1 million votes cast. We want to be careful about expecting the mandate of the majority speaking. They must participate in the election in order for that to occur. That's basically just our comments from an administrative side of it.
Questions? Senator Tavares.
Well, the only place where this doesn't happen is in nonpartisan elections, isn't it?
Chair Starr, members of the committee, that's correct. The way the current resolution is written is just for political parties, but it does have a caveat that says, or any other office as provided by law. Now, I did not check with legislative counsel whether that would give the legislature then the future ability to add to that nonpartisan issue.
But I guess I was saying, Colleen, is that in the way we're structured off, we're talking about the, for example, the superintendent of schools.
That's correct.
Well, you, in fact, the last cycle was pretty good when you had five or six people running in the primary.
Uh-huh.
And
well,
the top two run off in the general, and obviously the winner take all.
Uh-huh.
So that would work to Mr. Seagrave. That system is sort of what Mr. Seagrave would like to see happen, is where you had a thinning down and then the top two run off.
Chair Starr,
I see that was ideal, sure. Because you had the highest turnout was in the general.
I think that's very true. The difference, of course, is unusual for us to see a 12-person race like we did for the superintendent of public instruction race at the primary.
Gee, maybe the answer to this problem is a nonpartisan election system.
I just happen to have a bill that gets it, Mr. Chair.
Another whole discussion.
I would be very supportive of having that particular discussion.
No further questions?
No.
But appreciate very much the testimony. We're going to close the hearing.
Thank you.
And we will await a work session for a future day, if at all. That we close the public hearing, and if there's no further business, we will adjourn
the
Rules and Elections Committee.